Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
whisper. It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keyes, and here with co-host Bill Westphaler. Today is Thursday, December 19, 2013. And, Bill, this week we are celebrating number 222. What is 222?
It's the 222nd anniversary of the Bill of Rights.
Too bad there's nothing really to celebrate because it's all been destroyed, but it was a really cool idea.
Well, it's a good tip-off time. The actual anniversary was last Sunday, but it's a good tip-off to the NSA stories we're going to be covering and maybe a little discussion of the Fourth Amendment.
I think those are probably excellent things to talk about, considering all the news that's come out. We are going to start off with a little monetary policy, but we're going to get into the NSA stuff because the judge's ruling out of Washington District Court was quite earth-shattering, at least from the NSA's point of view. But the Fed has been up to their old tricks again, playing around with their QE, whatever version we're on right now. And that's really our top story this week, that they cut QE3 by $10 billion. And I don't know about you, Bill, but that just makes me shake my boots. I mean, this could be the end of life as we know it here on planet Earth.
I've decided I'm very sanguine about the whole issue. This is a cut in the explosion of the stock market and the explosion of the economic system, and they're slightly going to reduce it by 12%. But I was looking at the overall picture. And this $85 billion they're spending every month is more than the entire federal government budget put together. They are spending money buying up treasuries and buying up bad mortgages at a rate that exceeds the entire expenditures. And it's all with fake money, of course, but it exceeds the entire expenditures of the U.S. government. Now, I think what happened was that people were expecting this tapering to be a little bit more severe than 12%, but also Bernanke was very careful in saying that, you know, this is not going to be, a continuous tapering, and until we meet our goals and blah, 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 we're not going to trim it anymore, and so you can rest easy until 2017.
I've got to make you justify the claim here, because last I heard the Fed was spending, creating $85 billion a month. That works out to about a little under $1 trillion a year. But if I remember correctly, we have a budget that's over $2 trillion. So how does that work out?
Well, I'm not sure where you got the $2 trillion from. It was $1.1 trillion was the Ryan Murray budget for the next fiscal year.
Okay.
So,
but I'm not sure where I got either.
Yeah. We just pull numbers out of thin air, folks. There's no factual background to anything we say. But yeah, Bernanke was basically, and this is why the stock market went up a good amount, was basically saying that here's our new goals and objectives, so much unemployment, so much growth in the economy, so much this and that. And until we meet those goals, we're not going to stop doing what we're doing. So relax. That was his message. Yeah.
Well, I feel relaxed. How about you?
Well, like I said, I'm sanguine about him cutting down the destruction of the economy from $85 billion to $75 billion per month. That's a nice thing to do. But there's two beneficiaries from these purchases with the fake money that Bernanke creates by clicking on his computer. First of all, there's $40 billion in U.S. treasuries. Now, that totally eliminates any fear among politicians who think that if the Fed weren't doing this, they might have to pay higher interest rates for the federal debt, which is 17 or 18 trillion, I'm not sure what it is now. But if they have to start paying higher interest, then they have less money to spend on other things. So it's a little gift to the politicians. And the second half is a nice little gift to all of the financial institutions that were involved in the mortgage crisis, because they're spending $40 billion a month buying up securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These are the bad loans that are worth nothing, is what they're buying. And they're getting that out of the system so that all the financing companies and mortgage companies and the ones who are doing CODs and CDLs and CBAs and CRBs, whatever it was, are not going bankrupt. So they're saving the financial sector by spending $40 billion a month on these bad mortgages. So that's nice for them.
Okay. Well, think of it as like a Christmas bonus.
Something like that. And
They've done such a good job, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. It's been marvelous. You know?
If you make your career to go around and basically destroy the economy in every which way you can while extracting as much value as you can at the same time, I mean, these guys deserve huge bonuses, don't you think?
Well, like I say, I'm sanguine about it because what can you say? You know, I mean, it's just a little game they're playing. And meanwhile, you got this budget deal that basically wipes out at least half of the sequestering of spending by the federal government. So that's a nice, sweet thing, a good political move for the Republicans. So they don't have to argue about government shutdowns and stuff like that. But the thing is that it's related in a way that, you know, they're boosting up the stock market so they can say, well, GDP has grown. The government's spending more money, so they can say GDP has grown. But for every increase in government spending, the direct inverse effect is to reduce all of the private economic activity in the country. And we've got a secondary story that shows that the private sector, which excludes federal, state, local government activity, has shrank in 41 states since Obama became president.
Hmm.
Now, this is a study that was done by the Mercatus. Somebody out there. So they researched and they found that the private sectors had shrunk from 2007 to 2012. Several states, Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Idaho, and Nevada, have seen the largest contractions. Nevada's economy shrank by private economy, not the public economy. The private economy shrunk 13% below the 2007 levels. And this is something that politicians will hide to the day they die, that every additional penny that they spend in government is a penny that comes out of the private sector and damages all economic activity in the country.
Okay. Well, I would say that's more good stuff done. I think bonuses ought to be handed around to the guys at the top of the government, too. I mean, everybody's doing a great job this year.
You're so generous today.
While you were talking there, I was thrown a little bit by your comment about the budget, and so I just wanted a better place to go. I went to Wikipedia. Wikipedia's report on the United States federal budget under the subcategory major expenditure categories, they say during fiscal year 2013, the federal government spent $3.45 trillion on a budget or cash basis, down $84 billion or 2.4% versus fiscal year 2012 spending of $3.54 trillion. So I think that's where I got the idea that the budget was a little bit higher than $1
trillion. You know what it is? The $1 trillion is the discretionary spending. That's where I got, bollocks out there. So it's still a huge chunk of the budget. It's a third of the budget, and the Fed is spending more than that discretionary, funding that Congress can control. So
I mean, discretionary spending, because everything that the Fed is creating is discretionary creation. So you got discretionary creation on one side, discretionary spending on the other side. I mean, it goes hand in hand.
Well, discretionary is kind of a weird word because it implies that the Congress can't decide to do something different. For example, Social Security.
Well, they clearly can't. They keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, but legally, under the Constitution, anytime it wanted to, Congress, of course, with approval of the president, could shut down Social Security. They could shut down Medicare. They could shut down Medicaid. I mean, there is nothing, you know, in anything that the Congress passes that forbids a future Congress from totally eliminating those programs.
Yeah, so I mean, it would be political suicide, but that's
yeah. But it's still not. It's not as though it's not discretionary. It's just that they fixed it in the existing laws that X number of dollars will be spent based upon the demand. So, I mean, there has to be a better word than, you know, non-discretionary budget.
Let's just say they do it discreetly. How's that?
Yes, they do.
I mean, put it this way. When was the last time you heard the words discreet and trillion in the same sentence?
Well, they're politically discreet. That's the key. The key is they don't want to piss off anybody, you know. People are getting all kinds of benefits from the government one way or the other, and you know, the last thing you want to do is, you know, make people realize that it's all a game they're playing. But that's a different topic.
And unfortunately, you and I are in the crosshairs.
Oh, well. Yep.
Before we leave the topic of monetary policy, or I think we need something better than monetary policy, because even that word sounds discretionary.
let me interrupt you for a sec. It was interesting. I was actually watching Ben Bernanke's press conference and didn't fall asleep. I forced myself to stay awake. What's interesting is he was talking about the monetary policy, of course, you know, with all these numbers and junk like that. But he also made reference to the fiscal policy. Of course, the fiscal policy is what the government is spending. And so he was saying, you know, as long as the government's spending its money and it's doing, you know, whatever degree of stimulus it's doing, you know, we don't have to worry as much. We can still do this quantitative easing thing.
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, everything will be fine as long as the government's spending as much money as it possibly can.
I kind of wish that Bernanke, when he had been an academician, had decided to study history before the 20th century, like perhaps the colonial era. Because he would have discovered that this has been done before.
Well, you know, one of the incongruities is Greenspan. When he was at the Fed, basically doing the same thing to a much, you know, smaller degree, was at the same time saying that he agreed with Ayn Rand's view of monetary policy, that we should be going back on the gold standard. There shouldn't be inflation. There shouldn't be a Fed. So there's this massive irony, and every time Greenspan opened his mouth, that he was doing something that he thought was totally ridiculous. So it hasn't happened with Bernanke, and I'm sure it won't happen with Yellen, because they've got there's so many, you know, junk words, you know, made up terminology and stuff that they throw into these things. Anyone listening to it would have their brains mashed if they didn't understand the jargon. And Bernanke talks in jargon. He doesn't have a sentence with at least three jargon words in it that nobody would know what he was talking about unless they had a little help guide to figure out that fiscal meant government spending. So,
right, but of course that little document you referred to is classified, so you know you wouldn't be able to see it anyway.
Very top secret.
Well, we can't have Al-Qaeda getting a hold of it. Can you imagine what they could do with that?
Yes. They're gonna switch over all of the Fed payouts from dollars to bitcoins next week.
Speaking of bitcoins,
yes, I was.
There's a little news about bitcoins this week. Why don't you share the little bit of tidbit we've gotten from China about bitcoins?
Well, China has basically said, no, I don't think we're gonna do that. They have passed new laws The dictator there has changed the law. I'm not sure which. But saying that basically all Chinese companies are now banned from clearing services between Bitcoin and the Chinese, what is it? I don't know.
Yuan.
Tell me what the Chinese currency is. I don't even know.
It's the yuan, Y-U-A-N.
Yuan? Okay.
Yuan, yeah.
So anyway, they basically shut down any kind of Bitcoin exchanges within the Chinese government, which was one of the fastest growing demands for Bitcoin. As a consequence, Bitcoin dropped from $700 per bit to $480. But it isn't just China. There are literally dozens of other countries that are saying, no Bitcoin in our country. You can't trade Bitcoins and comply with the law. So it's kind of an interesting sidelight, and it'll be interesting to see what develops in the Bitcoin market. But having China cut out of the exchange market is a big problem for Bitcoin investors.
You know, I saw a little side note Bitcoin article about a web design firm in New Zealand, I think it was. Can't remember exactly where it was. But this web design firm apparently pays its employees in Bitcoins. And I was thinking about that, and to the best of my knowledge, no Bitcoin has actually been split yet. I mean, they do have a sub-currency, the equivalent of, say, cents to dollars, that kind of a thing, only it's a much smaller split than that. But to the best of my knowledge, nobody's actually split a Bitcoin yet. Well, Bitcoins are, what, $1,000 each? They must make an interesting paycheck, you know?
Well,
Bitcoin, that's $3,000.
The word may confuse people because there is no such thing technically as a coin.
Right.
It's not. It's a bit. It's a computer bit, and the value of that bit varies by 1,000,000,000th of a cent, so to speak, every other day. And so it's not as though there's a company that's issuing coins made of gold or silver or platinum or lead, who knows what. Even though every story about Bitcoin has a picture of these Bitcoins accompanying the story, which somebody is minting in Utah, I don't know where, they put a B with the dollar sign lines on it. And so it looks like it's actually a currency, a physical currency, or that has some kind of physical backing. But it doesn't. It's totally a private fiat currency. People get confused.
I think there's lots of room for confusion here, including among Bitcoin owners, I would venture to say. Mm-hmm. But the thing that gets me, though, is, I mean, Bitcoin, right, it's all about everybody who's involved in this Bitcoin, finagling, they all have the record of all the transactions that take place, right?
Yeah.
And when you have, up to 1.21 million Bitcoins, which I believe is what the final amount will be after about 30 years or something like that, I can kind of see where that becomes possible to track. But Bitcoins themselves are also subdividable into pieces. And I can't remember what the pieces are.
Yeah, it goes out to like 12 digits, like 1,000,000,000,000th of a penny. So it's the amount that you, for example, if I want to transfer you a dollar, it isn't a dollar amount. When it gets converted into Bitcoins, it's like 488.37256847.6 Bitcoins.
Right, but correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is no Bitcoins have been split up in this way.
No, they've always been split up. Like I say, the algorithm that they're using goes out to like 12 digits below zero, which sounds pretty cold to me.
But is there actually any trade in fractional amounts of Bitcoin?
Oh, well, yes and no. I mean, there is, individuals, who buy something from WordPress, which accepts Bitcoins. WordPress charges, $400 for their fancy, package. So they convert that from the U.S. dollars into the current Bitcoin value. And as it happens, Bitcoins right now are trading about $400, $500 per Bitcoin. So when that's paid, it gets converted almost instantaneously into dollars, so that it comes out approximately at the $400 that WordPress wants to charge for their particular product. Even though you're paying in Bitcoins, they don't get the Bitcoins. They convert them immediately to dollars.
Okay, I understand they're being converted to dollars, but that also implies that this quantity of fractional currency is being tracked.
The quantity of fractional currency?
Yeah, because we're not talking about nominal units, you know, one Bitcoin, two Bitcoin, three Bitcoins. We're talking about 0.496287 Bitcoins.
Right.
Okay. Well, that presumes that all those fractions are being tracked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, because you can store a 28-digit number in a couple of bytes.
And well, so I know
it,
you
it
can.
It doesn't matter to them. Yeah.
I have no doubt that you can store fractional numbers like that in a couple of bytes. I know that can be done because that's the nature of the way computer bits are calculated. That's not my question. That's not my concern. My concern is, at some point, the number of transactions that you have to track, presuming this actually starts to take off, becomes ridiculous.
Oh, I see. Yeah. If there are a million Bitcoins out there and there are 10 million transactions all in partial Bitcoins, it becomes very messy.
Extremely messy, and I don't care how good your computer is.
I don't know how they deal with that. I haven't looked into that side of the Bitcoin problem. But yeah, theoretically, if there are a billion transactions a day, and all those transactions get sent out to every participant to validate, it's going to wipe out a lot of computers because that's going to be, you know, trillions of kilobytes or megabytes or gigabytes or whatever it is every day that they've got to, you know, download into their computer. So that's a problem. The other problem is that there's no monopoly on Bitcoins. I mean, there are already like two or three different companies that are issuing their own version of Bitcoin with their own software and their own, you know, tracking mechanism and so on and so forth. So if Bitcoin looks like it's becoming accepted or profitable, you're going to see all kinds of competitors coming out with a better deal that doesn't have the same surcharge on every transaction and, you know, does this or that or has better encryption or whatever it is. So it'll be interesting to see what develops.
And when you say they're coming out with their own Bitcoins, are you saying that they're issuing their own base of their own monetary base of Bitcoins, or they're participating in the existing monetary base of Bitcoins?
No, they're creating their own banana coin. It's a banana coin company, and for every banana coin, you know, there are, you know, 5 million banana coins, and you trade banana coins instead of trading Bitcoins. Totally separate.
Doesn't this kind of defeat the whole idea that Bitcoin is limited?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin is theoretically limited in the number of coins that they're going to issue. Now, that doesn't actually come to an end for another, I think it's 3 or 4 years. They're like 60% completed in terms of their mining, is what it's called. So at some point, Bitcoin stops, but that doesn't preclude anybody else from setting up Banana Coin or Tiddlywinks Coin or whatever it is. That is a totally separate, you know, computer program with a totally separate reconciliation process. Because
they can call it
nothing.
A Bitcoin.
It's just fiat money. They just make it up.
Right, and they can call it a Bitcoin.
They can't call it Bitcoin because that's copyright.
Bitcoin is copyrighted?
Yeah, the name Bitcoin.
You mean trademarked?
Well, it's trademark... whatever it is.
Well, it makes a difference.
I'm just saying that if they call it banana coin or tiddlywinks coin, it doesn't matter what they call it. It's still doing the same thing that Bitcoin
kind of
does.
Thought, and that's my point. Because unless they aren't even a company. I don't know how to refer to them. But unless the conglomerate known as Bitcoin, unless they have a legal control over that name, and I don't see how they really can, because to the best of my knowledge, they aren't actually trademarked. You can't actually trademark something that's not an organization label. And they can claim copyright all they want to, but copyright has never, to the best of my knowledge, protected a name.
Yeah, you're right. No, you're right. It is trademark rather than copyright. But trademark has provisions in the U.S. at least, and I'm sure it's similar in every other country, of prior use. In other words, you don't have to file as a corporation to get ownership. So I think probably what Bitcoin is doing is saying, well, all of the participants, everybody who has a Bitcoin billfold is a member of the corporate entity that owns the rights to this name.
Yeah, but I don't think that's going to fly.
Well, we'll see.
I really don't know how that flies. I mean, seriously, corporate law is very specific about what constitutes a corporation. It includes filings, it includes organizational structure, includes annual meetings, all that kind of stuff. And each state does it a little bit differently, but it's very well defined. I don't see Bitcoin meeting any of the criteria.
Well, no, I mean, there are clauses in the trademark law, and again, we're talking about the U.S., not talking about other countries, because I wouldn't have the slightest idea what other countries do. But for example, you can have a collective membership mark that it does not belong to any particular corporation, and it doesn't have to have any filing. It's just that you have identifiable members who are participating in an organization or process, and you can have a mark, a trademark, that identifies that collective membership. Now, I happen to know that only because I was very active in a 527 organization, which is not incorporated, which was the Republican Liberty Caucus, which is a political organization, and we have a collective membership mark right to the name RLC or Republican Liberty Caucus, and we can prosecute in court anyone who misrepresents that they are the RLC.
Yeah, but there's a huge difference. The RLC, now you know the RLC a lot better than I do, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the RLC has a strength, has a central leadership structure, doesn't it? Does it not?
Oh, yeah, but it's still a collective member. In other words, all of the members are members of the organization.
The point is it does have that structure, and I would imagine that a court would recognize a filing in court by that structure claiming protection of its name. I don't see a court making the same kind of recognition of an amorphous, non-organized, decentralized group.
I have no idea how the courts would handle that. I mean, if somebody started, you know, their own program that and called it Bitcoin, it was a fake Bitcoin, and it wasn't really being, you know, using the Bitcoin software. And somebody in Bitcoin said, "We got to, you know, file a lawsuit against these guys." I don't know how the courts would respond.
I mean, that'd be sort of an equivalent to Occupy Wall Street. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have a central leadership structure either. It has some groups that kind of try to lead directly or indirectly, but there's no formal structure to it.
Same thing with the Tea Party. The Tea Party has no hierarchical structure. Yeah.
So what if like the National Tea Party came along and decided to do another Tea Party for using the name Tea Party? I don't think that works. I don't think that flies.
I don't know how the courts would respond if there were a suit filed by somebody. I mean, there are various kinds of Tea Party coalitions, but there are literally thousands of Tea Party organizations, all of which have their own positions on issues and their own priorities and their own participants and their own membership. Because you don't pay dues to be a member of the Tea Party. You just say, "Hey, I'm a Tea Party."
and I can just see what would happen if, say, a Tea Party group or an Occupy Wall Street group or a Bitcoin group or whatever decided to file a lawsuit saying we have legal standing to represent Bitcoin or Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party. I can just see everybody else in those circles say, "Hey, wait a minute, you don't have that standing." I can see it getting challenged within their own circles.
Yeah. I don't know how the courts would deal with that. They may just take it on, like you say, a standing issue. You don't have standing to represent that name, so.
Exactly. I think the whole concept is silly, but we had to have a little fun, so I figured why not have fun with something that's silly, you know?
Sure.
Listen, we're 2 minutes from the break. Let's take the break early, and then after the break, let's pick up on the really interesting subject this week, which is the NSA, because, of course, that judge issued his ruling, and now all of a sudden the foundations of the NSA building in Maryland are falling apart. Well, not really, but we'll talk about that after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Talking about a revolution. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bills, on this Thursday, December 19th. And Bill, before the break, we were talking about Bitcoin. You know, it did occur to me there is actually one organization I can think of that does have the computing power to handle all those transactions.
And let's be honest, they're going to have a whole bunch of free computing power available to themselves if a national, if a U.S. district judge named Richard Leon has his way.
Yeah, NSA could start up its own Bitcoin operation. And, it was interesting. For the past 2 weeks, I've been speculating that the next revelation from Snowden was going to be that the U.S. government was involved in currency manipulation using NSA cyber warfare division or whatever the heck it was. Well, one of the things that Clapper, in his testimony, made reference to was economic activity and snooping that benefits U.S. companies. And, you know, aside from their Stuxnet kind of stuff. And in this latest report that came out on the NSA, Recommendation 31, I'm going to read it. I think I've got it. You've got to copy of this, but these are recommendations that they're making about changing the current policies. So it says, we recommend the U.S. should support international norms and agreements for specific measures that will increase confidence in the security of online communications. Among those measures to be considered are, number one, government should not use surveillance to steal industry secrets to advantage their domestic industry. Now, pause here. I mean, politicians have been screaming bloody murder about China stealing corporate secrets and stuff like that. But these are recommendations about what our government should not be doing. So you have to assume that they have, in fact, been stealing industry secrets from companies in other nations to give advantage to their domestic industry, probably, you know, defense contractors and government contractors. Number two.
We pointed that out last week. Last week we pointed out that the official policy of the NSA, among other things, is to work for the benefit of U.S. businesses. So, I mean, that would dovetail perfectly with that policy.
And number two was government should not use their offensive cyber capabilities to change the amounts held in financial accounts or otherwise manipulate the financial systems. Again, if that's what they're recommending the U.S. government should not do, we can presume that that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like the LIBOR scandal, but in a different, totally different context.
I love that phrase. Offensive. What was it again?
Offensive cyber capabilities.
Wow, cyber capabilities. Being. Have you ever been offended by a cyber capability?
This is non-kinetic warfare.
Oh, I see. Okay.
This is throwing bits around. And, you know, one of the other recommendations was that they divide out the NSA capabilities from snooping and cyber warfare. So cyber warfare is there not just a matter of, you know, developing security for their systems or industry systems, but actually attacking other foreign businesses and governments, not just listening in, but actually attacking them and changing their financial accounts and manipulating their financial systems. And that was the first thing that, practically the only thing, when Obama released this report, they said they would never consider doing. Cyber warfare was going to stay in the NSA, period, end of story.
Well, of course, you don't want any competition.
So anyway, this report, again, I'm sanguine about it. They came up with a lot of, 46 different recommendations, and they stipulated a half dozen different principles. What is really surprising is they really slapped Obama and the NSA across the face. Said, you can't do this. Principle number one, the U.S. government must protect at once two different forms of security: national security and personal privacy. My God, you can't tell a government to respect personal privacy. The only thing that's important to them is national security, and they have to do that at all costs. And national security, of course, primarily means protecting their own butts from being blamed for something that might happen that was beyond their control.
But that,
was a first principle.
What was the source of this report?
Oh, this was a group that Obama appointed. Includes five different people, all of them former NSA people, CIA people, counterterrorism advisors. You probably recognize some of the names, like Richard Clark. The CIA guy. Mike Morrell, who's the former deputy director of the CIA. Jeff Stone. Cass Sunstein is a well-known leftist political commentator and author. These five guys who supposedly are good buddies of Obama and good buddies of the NSA came out with this report to say, hey, you have to respect personal privacy as much as national security. My God, this is something where it's practically grounds for burning at the stake to even suggest that they have to, you know, create a balance or do some kind of cost-benefit analysis. So
I think I'm becoming cynical. I really do. No, I'm serious. I think I'm becoming cynical because I hear this report and I say, yeah, right. So where's the other shoe?
Oh, no.
Just don't believe that this is a serious report. I don't think this is anything that anyone's going to stand by.
Oh, no. There is absolutely no obligation. In fact, Obama didn't even want to release this thing. He got it and he said, what are you guys, crazy? You know, what is this stuff? I can't believe he came up with this kind of recommendations. He said, let's put it in the back office for a couple of months so that people don't read it and they don't see what you recommended and they don't get the impression that I endorse it, among all things. And there was so much pressure from so many different people and politicians and Congress and so on and so forth saying, hey, where's the report? Where's the report? Where's the... So he let it out instead of holding it for a couple of months, which is what he said he was going to do. I mean, he just formed this commission out of thin air. He had no obligation or power or ability to create this commission. He just said, okay, you guys go off and, you know, figure it out and let me know what you think and I'll think about it and maybe I'll do something, maybe I won't.
Well, yeah, I believe it falls into the category of a blue ribbon commission, which is basically a commission that makes a recommendation that nobody ever listens to.
Right.
But the thing that strikes me about all this is the falseness of it, because I honestly don't believe they really believe in all this thing. I suspect that if you could somehow parse what they're actually saying in this report, what you'd find out that their use of the words privacy and protection have very different meanings from what you and I would associate with those words.
Well, so what's surprising? What's surprising is that it isn't. It's very explicit. For example, principle number three. I'll quote a paragraph. In a free society, public officials should never engage in surveillance in order to A, punish their political enemies, restrict freedom of speech or religion, suppress legitimate criticism or dissent, or to help preferred companies or industries, or to provide domestic companies with an unfair competitive advantage, or to benefit or burden members of groups defined in terms of religion, ethnicity, race, and gender. Now, that's a pretty radical statement about what the government should and shouldn't be doing. I mean, one another quote from, like, page from 114 to 300, quote, Americans must never make the mistake of wholly trusting our public officials again. Like I said,
Stop. I'm sorry. I don't buy this. I would love to buy it, but I don't buy it because I'm looking at the characters of the people who are issuing this statement.
Yeah,
these are
which
people
is amazing.
Who lie. These are people who lie for a living. And they've already shown all the different ways that they've lied in the past. Why should we have any reason to believe that they're not lying now?
Well, no, I mean, but what they're doing, and it's actually a fairly well-done report. I mean,
yeah, it sounds like a great piece of propaganda.
But there's two different sides of it. One side of it is, here's our principles. They set out four principles, and then they go through this list of 46 recommendations. Well, the 46 recommendations don't quite implement the principles. Basically, what they recommend in terms of concrete changes are minor esoteric modifications, the most popular of which is, rather than the NSA building a big facility in Utah to store all this stuff, let's give it to a private contractor so that the NSA doesn't have actual possession of all this metadata from phones and internet, but they can access it anytime they want. What a ludicrous proposition. I mean, they're changing the location of the metadata. They're mandating the phone companies to provide the data to some other private entity, and they have full access to it. It's just totally superfluous, you know, shuffling of chairs on the
Titanic. I'm not so sure it's superfluous. I sense that there's an actual intent going on there, because you put it into the hands of a private company, and essentially you've accomplished the same thing that was accomplished a little over 100 years ago with a little thing called the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting parallel.
It's a quasi-governmental authority. It's private, but it's not private. And look at all the heck that has been rendered by that quasi-private organization where the money supply is concerned. Consider what kind of heck could be rendered by a quasi-public, quasi-private organization that was engaged in dealing with the subject of privacy.
Well, remember what I said last week? There's no such thing as quasi. This is what fascism looks like.
Mm.
The government sets up the criteria. They select the people, they pay all the money, and they totally control every aspect of their operations, but it's private. It's a private company, and that's what fascism is, where you have the illusion that there are private actors that are concerned about consumers, but none of them are. They are not quasi-government. They are agents, hired agents of the government, and that's fascism.
And that's why I don't believe a word of that statement that was issued. Not one single word. I mean,
like
it all
say,
sounds great. It's got all the right rhetoric. I mean, it could have pulled it right out of the news cycle.
Yeah, but see,
they didn't mean anything.
They didn't have to put in all that rhetoric. They didn't have to, you know, make these statements that are really
I think they did. I think this becomes the basis for the Obama administration and even for future administrations. Because let's be honest, it's not going to end with President Obama. Obama leaves in 2016, right?
Yeah.
Or at the end of 2016, and then the new autocrat in chief takes over. And when that happens, the same policies continue. Well, they need to have talking points to be able to mollify the electorate into believing that they're really fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. Well, this provides one. This gives them the rhetoric they need to do that. They don't actually have to be true to these principles. You already outlined how they're not true to it even in that own document, in their own document that they wrote up. But just by putting it out there, they can make it sound like they are. And I think that's what the real motivation is here. I think they're laying a framework, a baseline, if you will, for future rhetoric. Basically aimed at saying, we have changed. We have made – we are now the new and improved NSA, and we respect privacy.
Well, the problem is that they handed all of this very good rhetoric to all the opponents of the NSA. So this report in itself is almost a full-fledged endorsement of Rand Paul's and Justin Amash's, U.S. Privacy Act or something like that, of all of the provisions they've got in that to roll back the NSA. So they can start quoting the president's own report, blue panel or whatever, green panel, and start to quote, you know, phrase by phrase. For example, here's one particular section that's particularly noteworthy. Quote, significant steps should be taken to protect the privacy, not just of U.S. citizens, not just of people living in the U.S., but of non-U.S. persons. In particular, any programs that allow surveillance of such persons even outside the United States should satisfy six different constraints. And I won't go through and read them all, but they're very, very strict confinement on what they can do in terms of surveilling non-U.S. citizens, totally separate from U.S. citizens. And those six provisions are something that's going to be grabbed up by the opponents of all the NSA surveillance going on. In other words, a lot of people who are NASA enthusiasts like to divide it up, and they say, well, you know, this isn't happening to U.S. people. It's just foreigners like Angela Merkel. You know, she's a crazy person in Germany, and we're monitoring her stuff. But we don't listen to your telephone calls. We don't read your email. We just do all these foreign guys because they're probably terrorists. So it's going to be very difficult for Obama rhetorically to use this report to preserve the status quo. It is
I don't agree with that. I think it's going to be very easy. It's going to be very easy to do. And we already have a number of glimmers as to how easy it's going to be. For instance, there are supposedly a whole bunch of strictures and limitations and so forth in place that the NSA routinely ignores. And we know now that they routinely ignore it because Edward Snowden showed us that they routinely ignore their own rules. They ignore their own FISA court half the time. And the FISA court is in their pocket, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
So, you know, this whole notion that if you put new rules in place that it's somehow going to keep the NSA chained where it should be is just plain ludicrous. I mean, the only thing that's going to actually change the NSA is to drastically shrink or eliminate the NSA. And this is where I have a little problem with the Rand Pauls and the Justin Amashes of the world. I'm not convinced they're ready to go that far. I think they're going to become the cat's paw, so to speak, for the NSA's continued existence by giving it the cover that it needs through creation of all these new rules and so forth to limit it, but without any actual teeth to make sure that a limitation takes place, because the moment you put teeth in is the moment you undermine national security.
Yes. No, I mean, here's the thing. National Security Agency, in theory, was set up in order to get intelligence on foreign governments, because they knew in the NSA that politicians lie. All they had to do was look at their bosses, because politicians lie about what their capabilities are and their intentions are.
Well, it's just their mouths. Just when the mouths are open, they're lying.
They're moving. This will be the new NSA directive. Report to the president whenever a politician's lips are moving. So there's an argument, you know, in theory, that for diplomatic purposes and other purposes and negotiations, it's useful to know what politicians are actually doing rather than what they're saying. And so if the NSA, you know, provides the president or the Congress or whoever with useful information about what lies the politicians are telling in foreign countries, that's theoretically, you know, a valid service to the president of the Congress and Pentagon and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, there's an argument to be made that there is some function in the general category of what the NSA does that actually makes sense. But that is used to justify the most broad, ridiculous propositions and interventions and surveillance and spying even manipulation of foreign markets and foreign currency and everything else and all this other stuff that's going on. It comes under this big, huge umbrella that they call national security. I mean, national security is whatever they want, you know.
Yeah.
And so it isn't confined to a particular specific task. It's just grown, and they use this word actually in the report, it's grown beyond Orwellian proportions. Which to me is not rhetoric that Obama is going to use, and certainly not Clapper and Alexander.
Well, I'm glad somebody used that word. That was good because it was accurate. We've got 7 minutes left, and we do have a couple of the stories we're going to talk on regarding the NSA, but you have a topic that I think is directly related to all this. Let's put all those NSA stories that we have left aside and go to that topic, because that topic is really what the NSA has most directly attacked, and that is the Fourth Amendment. And I know you've been doing some research on this, so I figured this is a good time to bring it up. We'll put the rest of the agenda aside and give us a little education on what the various implications are, where the Fourth Amendment is concerned with not just the NSA, but a variety of other things that the U.S. government's been doing.
Well, I'll try to abbreviate this to squeeze it in. It was like a 20-minute speech when I gave my overview on the issue.
Plus, I just used up one of your 7 minutes, so you got it.
I got 7 minutes. Probably the most important thing I can do is read the actual amendment. And this is really the heart of the entire Constitution in terms of implementing the ideas in the Declaration of Independence, that every person has a natural right to their own life, liberty, and property, and pursuit of happiness. So the Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, that's it. It's one sentence. That's all it is. And its sole purpose is to secure the right of the people to their own persons, houses, papers, and effects. Well, when people are discussing the NSA programs, what they commonly do is divide it into two parts, and they put a period at the end of shall not be violated, which means that this concept of unreasonable becomes the primary factor in how and when it is proper or reasonable to violate those rights. Totally detaching it from the other half of the statement, which follows with an and makes it all one. And what the founders were very economical in terms of the words, but if you read it word for word, you can insert a phrase into the middle, and that is that people's rights should not be violated or shall not be violated, and the only warrant for a violation is when a judge independently decides there is probable cause to believe that a person is involved in the commission of a crime. Now, given that understanding and that, you know, probable cause requirement, none of any of the things the NSA does, nor the FBI for that matter, comply with the Fourth Amendment. They can only seize, you know, these different things when they specify what they are. They can't use broad warrants to grab everything that they want to get, like everybody's phone calls. And the reason why that this clause was put in was because King George, prior to the Revolution, was issuing general warrants authorizing fishing expeditions and any British agents to have the power to go in and seize anybody or anything they wanted to, merely on the basis of suspicion. Now, it was interesting that Alexander was interviewed on this big 60 Minutes of Ballyhoo, and he lied twice. He said that the NSA was only looking at or targeting the communications where they had probable cause to believe they were engaged in terrorism. Well, that's a lie. That is not in the FISA court. That is not in any of the laws or anything else. The standard for FISA is articulable suspicion. That means if you have some suspicion and you can say it in words, that is sufficient to grab whatever you want. So that's the overall viewpoint on the Fourth Amendment. But one important word in the Fourth Amendment is the word effects. And it isn't just property. It isn't just people. It's the effects of those people. And one of the effects that you create as an individual is dialing a phone, which is giving instructions to your service provider that you want to connect with a particular number. So these effects, just seizing that effect, is also an explicit violation of the Fourth Amendment. Now, what the Fourth Amendment really means, of course, is finally decided, right, correctly or wrongly, by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has had three different cases that they've looked at, the Fourth Amendment and how it relates to capturing information. Now, I don't know if we've got enough time to go through all of them, but for those who are interested...
Less than 50 seconds, so you got to be real quick.
Okay, I'll be quick. For those that are interested in the Supreme Court rulings, you can Google these names, because these are very technical terms, but remember Katz, K-A-T-Z, Smith, and Jones. Those are the three cases, and I call the first one good, the second one bad, and the third one ugly. So if you want to get a little background on how the Fourth Amendment has been interpreted, check those three cases, Katz, Smith, and Jones.
Yeah, if you can't remember them, just look up old Clint Eastwood films. You'll be covered.
There you go.
By the way, one other point I want to throw in, I think there's another key word in the Fourth Amendment, and that word is unreasonable. And it was written, let's be honest, the Bill of Rights was written essentially by James Madison, He's basically taking ideas of the day, and he's the one who put the final wording together, and he's the one who put in the word unreasonable. Unreasonable is whatever the person reading it who's in charge decides is unreasonable, and that's where the whole standard starts to get a little bit weak.
But only if you ignore the second half of that one sentence. In other words, the only thing that's reasonable is...
It just depends on whether or not you think it's reasonable to do so.
I know. That's what they want you to think, the Fourth Amendment.
That's right. Well, anyway, it's been a pleasure as usual, Bill.
Hey.
Hey, we'll catch you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.